This is Jeff Chrisman, and I'm here today on the Living Arts of Tulsa podcast, and I am very joyous and very grateful to have the opportunity to be able to visit with Steve Liggett. Steve, thank you so much for taking the time with me today. I really appreciate this.
Happy to do it, Jeff.
Yeah. I wanted to, before we start, and of course there are, you know, numerous questions I'd love to be able to ask and to be able to hear more about your journey, I did want to take a few moments and really honor the involvement and leadership that you have, what you've given of your time and energy and resources to the Tulsa arts scene and the Tulsa arts community for all of these years. And of course, as the former executive director of Living Arts of Tulsa as well, and now an artist, and you have been an artist in your own right and with your gallery. I know that's a lot of words, but I really did want to make sure and just give people some context as far as, you know, why I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Well, I've been around a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is what I know how to do.
So well, I definitely appreciate your time today and your presence here with me. I was going to start out, I thought what I would do is ask you, and of course, I also have numerous questions to ask you about your life journey and what it was like here when you first got, you know, when you first got here to Tulsa and were involved in the art scene. I thought I would ask you first, if I could, just as far as your own work as an artist yourself and just in your experiences, if I could ask you just in your own words what this all means to you at a deeper level.
Well, I started out in art at ORU, actually. I was a business major there. I came to Tulsa because of ORU, put my hands on the television screen, and I was electronically transmitted through the television and up over there. And it was the abundant life, you know. It was the promise of being able to be at a school in those days for me that was Christian based, and it was had an art department. But I was a business major for a while, transferred to TU when I really got into clay, and met Tom Manhart. Tom and I became real close friends, as well as he was my mentor for many years. And he was the one who actually told me to go hear a concert with Virginia Myers, who at Har Weldon back in, I believe it was 75. And she crawled inside her piano and started playing and from the inside of her piano, which freaked me out entirely. And because of my background at ORU, I felt like she was demon possessed. And I stormed back into TU the next day and complained to Tom about, why would you send me to a demon filled woman playing a concert? A potter doesn't need to know anything else except for to know about the clay, for God's sake. And he just laughed. He didn't make fun of me, though. That was the key thing. He didn't make fun of me. He just said, well, you ought to hang out with that demon-possessed woman, and she might actually know a few things you don't. Wow. So I hung out with her a little bit, but it wasn't until the 80s that I really started getting more involved with Living Arts. I became a facilitator in the schools in the late 70s, and went in with Living Arts education program, and did a lot of work with children in the schools, and trusting their instincts and trying to open their own creativity to feel confident in what urges that actually motivated them. So what does it mean to me? Well, it means everything to me. You know, the life that I've led has been really one that has been the abundant life. You know, Oral got it wrong, I think. You know, I mean, he took that phrase to mean something that is more about money and prosperity. And I think what it really means is just a whole heck of a lot of it, whole heck of a lot of life, you know. And that's what I have been living since, I don't know, forever, maybe.
I love that. I love that. Thank you. And I was going to ask as well, and this is just kind of coming up intuitively, was there, I guess, getting a sense of, was there, and I don't want to assume anything, was there kind of an aha moment where you found yourself gravitating towards, I guess, what you'd refer to as the avant-garde, or, you know, as far as art that really pushes, you know, pushes people's yeah. limits and opens minds?
My goal was to become a production potter. And I felt like that would be an honorable way to make a living. And when I handed somebody a clay piece that I had made, I could say, this won't blow up in your microwave. And when I got a commission from Sirloin Stockade to make 500 bowls, after I finished that, which is another story, I felt like I'd rather drive a truck than do that again. And you know, my ideas kind of went different directions as to the pieces I wanted to make. Ruth Armstrong, the great ceramicist here in Tulsa that was active in the 70s and 80s, she told me one day, Steve, don't you have a job that makes money? And I said, yes. And she said, you don't have to do this kind of work. You can do anything. Hmm. And I thought, wow, you know, I actually was a single parent for a while, and I had to get a job because I didn't want to put my daughter through a lot of years of really struggling financially while I made my career as a production potter. And when she said that, it made me think about making one-of-a-kind pieces and more statements rather than production pieces. Even though I still love to make things that people can eat and drink out of, I love that. I mean, there's a connection with the person's body and that I really love about that. But that led to me actually doing more one-of-a-kind artworks. And I started making pieces in clay because I was a potter, right? I was a ceramicist.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the medium I knew. And I kept having these pieces fall over in the kiln, and it just wasn't working. And so I met this guy at Johnson Atelier. I got a job out of college at Johnson Atelier with the Parks and Recreation Department that later became Waterworks. We started it out in the, 78 or 77, somewhere in there. And I told him about the problem I was having with the pieces. And he said, well, you know, the difference between the artist and the craftsman is that the craftsman tries to conform all their ideas to the material that they know the most about. And the artist uses any material to best communicate their ideas. And I thought, wow, you know, I could use anything. I am not just a potter anymore. So I started working with handmade paper. I started working with rattan. I started working with photography and performance art. And I went to New York in about 1984 and saw Meredith Monk and the amazing performance artist that uses her voice in quite miraculous ways. And I came back to Tulsa and I was talking to somebody at Cafe Olé on Peoria. And man, I just saw this amazing performance in New York and Meredith Monk, and the woman next table was Virginia Myers. And she turned around and she said, you know who Meredith Monk is? And I said, yeah. And just saw her in New York. She said, you ought to get more involved with living arts. So even though I had been an educator in the education program, I then became more active in the administrative part of living arts. And then when Virginia died in 1991, I gathered the little bit of the board that was left back together, and they made me the artistic director rather than the executive director. It was really the artistic director the whole time. So I took that on, and I was breaking up with my wife at the time, Charlotte Ray, and moved into the old Brick House Gallery at Cameron in North Main, which now is the Hunt Club, and started the group on a reorganization process. And a lot of that, before that, actually, while I was at Johnson, I started becoming more interested in contemporary art, and especially after that experience with Meredith Monk and my time with S.K. Duff. We brought S.K. in for a performance at the Performing Arts Center, and it blew everybody's socks off and caused a great disturbance. And I got written up several times over that one. And we started Tulsa Artists Coalition. We had a beginning. The point was to create a space in Tulsa that would be affordable studio space for artists, a place to perform and a place to exhibit your work that was uncensorable. I'd been censored a couple of times at Johnson Atelier with the City of Tulsa, and I wasn't going to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. So when Virginia died and I became the artistic director, then that was my whole premise, was the mission, you know, of Living Arts is to present and develop contemporary art forms. And Living Arts had a very specific way of defining those terms. And Virginia had it all laid out. Like, she knew that people eventually would say, well, contemporary, you know, doesn't that mean anything that's going on today? And she said, no, it doesn't mean that. We are not a community arts center. We are here for the reason of presenting the most extraordinary and what she called history in the making kinds of artwork.
Yeah.
Not just anything going on today. And that piece that she played at Har Weldon that I thought she was demon possessed at was a recent composition by the great composer George Crumb. And it was for prepared piano. And I had a lot to learn, I found.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you as well. I didn't want to assume anything as far as the performance art that Living Arts brought here. I mean, was that really the only organization in those days? You know, let's say in the 70s or in the 80s that was.
Oh yeah.
Like that, it was,
you know, Virginia Myers was actually my female mentor, and she was the one who brought in Joan Jonas, who recently was in the Venice Biennale. She brought in John Cage, for God's sake. John Wow. Cage, I had never even heard of John Cage. And so I did a lot of homework before that one. And we had, actually, I was still at Johnson, and we had some workshops showing how he composed using the I Ching, where he threw the pennies and made the universe part of his process in actually putting together works based on random selection or the universe.
My goodness, yeah.
That was really, really amazing. And, you know, she brought in Philip Glass for the first time. And then I just wanted to continue the traditions that she had started with Chuck Tomlins, who was the sculpture teacher at University of Tulsa, and Manly Johnson, the poetry person at TU, and Kitty Roberts that was actually became American Theater Company, and others. You know, Living Arts has it's the oldest contemporary arts organization in the Midwest. And now we just went through our 50th anniversary, and it could be, I haven't looked on Mars, but I think it might be the oldest contemporary arts organization in the universe.
My goodness. Wow. Yeah, that's that is saying something without a doubt. Yeah. And I was going to ask too, just in terms of, and of course, not being at the age where I could really, feel the reverberations of this, so to speak, let's say in 70s through the 80s, it would be very interesting if there's anything you could speak to, and I don't want to put you on the spot at all, but just, how does something like these performances in this kind of art, is there a certain way that it does reverberate through the community just in terms of the reactions? And
you mean as far as acceptance?
Yeah. Or lack of acceptance, kind of both.
Well, in 1993, I have to tell you a story to lead into the answer of that. 1993, I was at Mayfest in May of 93. And Mayfest was a dynamic event at one time. They held a lot of interesting performances and installations, etc. And they took a lot more risks in those days than they have recently. But I met a woman who said, who had all of this work in her booth at Mayfest. And I said, wow, this is a lot of work. How do you make so many pieces? And she said, on a good day, I can make 250 of these paintings.
Wow. My goodness.
And I thought, at that point, art becomes commodity.
Yeah.
And it's just like a little widget being pumped out. And so I started the New Genre Festival in order to present performances and artworks that were stimulating and made people really, really question and ask, well, what is art anyway? No, it doesn't attract huge audiences. It does attract probably less than 0.1% of the population that's interested in art at all.
Well, I had no idea. My goodness.
Because, and this is what I'm trying to get this this diagram that Virginia used to use, because when an idea is new, it comes into the world, it's so, if it truly is new, nobody hardly accepts it or wants to hear it or wants to see it. It's so foreign to them. And that's what I experienced seeing Meredith Monk. I didn't even know the questions to ask, much less the answers of what she was doing and why. That is the sensation that I have constantly been after in Living Arts and now Liggett Studio, although Liggett Studio is really much more of a community arts organization than Living Arts was, because of our missions are different. But then it becomes a little bit more interesting to a larger group and then even a bigger group. And then it's like everybody accepts it. And then that idea becomes kind of jaded. And then people start like saying, well, that was great like 10 years ago, but now, what's new now? So New Genre was created to be able to show those artists that were really, really doing history in the making kinds of works that we could afford. And I pushed the envelope on that, because a lot of times, when you actually see somebody like that, it's at a place or a location where there's a crowd. And they've already gone many times to that next level. And I also wanted to support local people who were doing those kinds of works or experimenting and giving them a forum that they could then collaborate with other people that were interested in like-minded pieces. And that's what Living Arts was. So that's a long way to get to your answer. Sorry.
Oh, I know. I appreciate that. I really do, because it's so beautiful to understand, you know, how cutting edge this was, and I had no idea in terms of, you know, that this was something that was definitely, I guess, would you call it out of the mainstream? It sounds like there was, you know, in terms of the percentage of people.
If it was mainstream, we didn't do it. Anything that was mainstream. Now, we did have fundraisers. And fundraisers deal with mass appeal. Champagne and Chocolate was a good example. We did O Tulsa, which was a fundraiser of a sort. But we always tried to put an edge on it somehow, you know, so that it wasn't like everybody else is doing, you know. And that's what actually got us the attention of the Andy Warhol Foundation and the National Performance Network, because those two are national organizations that deal across the United States. And and the Kaisers, actually. You know, I mean, why would they want just another community arts organization? You know, why? We were doing things that, people recognized Living Arts before they even knew anything about Tulsa. They recognized the new genre festival because, wow, you know, oh, you had this person or that person come to Tulsa, Oklahoma? Really? Wow, check that out, you know? So it was a network over 26 years of talking an artist or a performance artist talking to another performance artist and say, yeah, well, you know, while you're on your way to Chicago, then check out Living Arts. So I would have people call me up in the middle of the day and say, hey, we're coming through Tulsa. You got a place that we could perform? And I'd look at, you know, what they did and say, yay or nay, you know? And most of the time I would say yay, because you know, it was usually good stuff, you know, like the cloud seeding circus of the performative object. 11 people that got into two or three cars and took off from Florida to Santa Fe. And they were performance artists in the guise of a circus. Mm. And they had everything in their vehicle to do these amazing performative object pieces. So, I think we had maybe 20 people who saw them, and there should have been 2,000, but no. I mean, even when we brought in Meredith Monk years after I saw her, we only had maybe 300 people that showed up at the Chapman Music Hall, you know. John Cage, same thing. It's because we don't know these names. Now, when Living Arts brought in, the Kronos Quartet, you know, that was somebody that people recognized from, you know, occasionally, NPR or somebody would play some of their music, and they were always on tour, and Philip Glass, that another name that people recognized. But people like, Robert Mueller or all kinds of people, we'd get low audiences. But you have to be out there doing this kind of work in order for then the opera, Tulsa Opera, to be able to say, oh, well, Living Arts brought in Philip Glass. Let's commission him to do an opera. And so they did.
Huh, yeah.
And it's you need a vanguard. You need that person or group out there doing the most cutting edge ideas to give things like the Arts District Now, I mean, there are people doing lots of things like that. I mean, 108 Contemporary brings in amazing artists, and AHA has like an entire floor that they've given over to the experience. Well, Living Arts was doing that in the 70s, you know?
Yeah.
It's not new. It just finally has reached a place of massive understanding that this is really cool, and now it's rounding the peak, you know. Meow Wolf in Santa Fe is making a lot of money off of the great populace that goes to Santa Fe and then wants to go to their experience. And you know, it will always be the role of true artists, and I use that word carefully, as Virginia used to use that word carefully, that they are always doing something that is outside of the mainstream.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I was going to ask as well, I didn't know just anything you might share, or if I'm not sure if there's anything there in terms of this question, but it seems to be coming up. Just let's say, for instance, pre-internet days, you know, before you could just, you know, get on a computer and do a Google search for, you know, different performance art events or performance art groups. I was just wondering, was it quite a bit of work to, you know, in terms of networking and finding out about what was going on, let's say on the East Coast or the West Coast or larger metro areas, just in terms of what was going on that was new?
That's why the importance of Living Arts Archives is so important, because Virginia kept everything. Absolutely, yeah. Everything. She was writing letters to people, and she was looking at magazines. She was going to conferences, and she would find out through, I mean, you know, we had the mail, believe it or not, in the old days. The mail was the thing. And so she took a lot of newsletters and so I inherited all of that stuff. It was a mess, and still is a mess, really. You know, when Living Arts got kicked out of the Living Arts House over by Skelly Stadium, TU, we were using like a house that they knew they were going to tear down eventually and build a stadium. Virginia was in such bad health, and nobody was around, and they just threw it literally into an apartment building and scattered everything around.
Oh, my goodness.
And so when she died, Franklin Wassmer and I went into that apartment and stuffed all of those things into boxes and saved them all. And, you know, we didn't have time or understanding of what was even there, but we knew that was the remainder of Living Arts at the first 20 years of its existence. And those archives have like newspaper clippings and magazines and lots of things about what was going on in the world of art that then led to Living Arts being such a prominent arts organization. So, yeah, we didn't have the internet until probably Living Arts probably got a website around 1997 or somewhere in there. And so after that, it was much more accessible.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And of course, and I do want to apologize, I was going to transition a little bit, because I would love to hear about, you know, your own art, you know, about your own artistic practice and about Liggett Studio and what that experience has been like. I do want to apologize. I'm so sorry that I said executive director. I somehow had mistaken that. And yeah, I did want to make sure that I mentioned that to you.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, my artwork changed when I heard that John Plouffe was his name that said that difference between the artist and the craftsman. And I didn't have a medium. I realized I didn't really think in those terms. And, you know, over the years, the ideas have gone the direction of my dreams or whatever I fancied. You know, it was really, another Mayfest story. You know, they commissioned Charlotte and myself, Charlotte Ray, to create an outdoor environment in the plaza of the Samson Plaza downtown. And so we created inflatables that went in between the buildings and a synthesizer artist that played the wind currents on those against the backdrop of those two black glass buildings.
Oh, and wow.
Using those as sort of a the staff on a sheet of music, he worked with the wind currents between that kind of vortex there to play those things. But that was then, you know. If somebody did it now, it wouldn't be new, you know. It was new then. And I always liked that. And I don't have, like, you know, some artists like Kim Doner, my God, she has a new idea every 5 minutes, but I don't know how she lives with herself, because she makes candy and she makes things out of this, and she writes books and she illustrates and all this stuff. She's amazing. But I don't have that many ideas. So I found that my medium, when I didn't have ideas for my own work, was living arts. And I could then create and hold a space for other artists to be able to create their own work. And so it became an art form for myself. That's why I referred to myself as an artistic director also, that living arts was my art form. And it was at odds with the board of directors many times, because they many times didn't always have the vision that I had for what we could do. And so, you know, I had to do this balancing act most of the time between what the board would, you know, understand or have the vision of, and what I would have the vision of. So I'd go back and forth from my own artwork, my personal artwork, to my living arts artwork. And now I don't have a board. And so I just do whatever I want, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and what has that been like for you, just in terms of maybe going back to when you opened the studio, just, you know, what that felt like to have your own space? And
well, you need people. You need people to help you with your vision. You need people to also understand what your vision is. And for a visual artist, even though I'm talking a lot right now, sometimes the vision is not totally clear in your mind. You have a knowing, as Virginia used to call it. You have a hunch or a intuitive thought that this is the direction to go. And so sometimes you made money and sometimes you lost money, you know? And so people just had to understand that. And that's the reason for having a board, was to raise money so that Living Arts could continue on its mission, as well as fundraising. You know, fundraising got even more important when we moved into the new building in at Detroit and Brady and Reconciliation Way now. It became somewhat of the West anchor to the Arts District along that strip. And we've been trying, in our book, Shirley's in my book, actually give a history of how the artists were down there in the early 70s, the late 70s and mid 80s, working towards having affordable space and a good gallery that was uncensorable. And we didn't have any money, and we didn't have any business understanding of that it takes a person like George Kaiser and the foundation and Ken Levitt to be able to come in and say, we believe in you and we'll help you and we want you. And, oh, you have the Andy Warhol Foundation behind you? Wow, I recognize that name. So once we got the Warhol Foundation help, other doors began to open. And that leads you into more responsibility in a practical world. You know what I mean?
Like
Bob Dylan used to say, you know, when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose.
Absolutely, yeah.
When you got something,
yeah,
you got to keep feeding the beast.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So David Sharp, bless his heart, has kicked me out of many buildings. And we started with him in 93 over at what's now the Hunt Club. We moved over to where the glass blowing studio was at 19 East Brady.
Had no idea. Interesting.
We moved over to Kenosha, right down from where I am now. And then we moved back to Brady in 2008 or 2009. And, you know, my point is it does take a village, because you get to a certain height in what you're doing where you, Steve Liggett, can't do it all. And your ideas continue to roll, but you need people to help. And so those people have to be carefully selected. Otherwise, you change the mission. And things are fragile. Things are very fragile. And we don't realize how fragile they are sometimes until they're gone. So we have something really remarkable in living arts and the history of it, and its mission is very unique. It's not a community arts center. It really has to be run as it was intended, as the vanguard. And risk-taking is part of that. And we have to deal with that, you know? And people have to support it. And they did. Eventually, you know, we had a following that was really, really quite remarkable. And, and you know, it was time to go. And I left. And I thought I would just, you know, be happy gardening and making my own work. And but then I had people coming to me saying, hey, we still need a place to show. And we still need a place to do our stuff. And so I had Liggett Studio. And initially, I was going to make it part of Living Arts.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, well, we were only two doors down from Living Arts. And so when the board said, no, we don't want any more responsibility, I said, okay, then I'll take it on myself. So I kept that as my own place for 15 years now. Right now we're booked all the way through 2021, and it doesn't show any sign of letting up. And I think the key is that you take calculated risks rather than blind risks, you know, but you have to take risks, you know, and you know, I screw up all the time, you know, and it's just, you have to you have to take those risks, and sometimes they are what you thought they were going to be, and sometimes they're not. But that's okay. That's what art's all about, really. You know, when you make a painting or you make a performance art piece, you don't know whether it's going to completely flop on its head or not, but you've got an inkling or a knowing, as Virginia used to call it.
Yeah, and I was going to say, it's so moving to me to hear you, you know, speaking about the you know, that people were coming to you and really wanting to have that place. And so I would have to think that it must feel like a tremendous honor. And I can also see the responsibility in that as well. I mean, in terms of creating that space where people can continue to, you know, to bring those, as you talk about bringing those things that are new, and having that opportunity to share that with, you know, with the folks of Tulsa.
Well, I'm very lucky. You know, I have an Irish background and I believe in luck. Oh yes, I do. She says I'm English.
That's great. That's great.
But, my DNA says, yes, I'm English, but also a lot Irish and Scotch. So yeah. I do have a lot of luck, you know. And, but, you know, it's like that old, you know, Three Stooges joke about, you know, they're all standing there in a line and the person says, okay, the person that's supposed to do this step forward, and everybody steps back one time and I'm left standing there. And that's a lot of what my life has been about, you know, and continue with that, you know, until I can't, you know. Someday I'll just fall over and that'll be it, you know.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And I was going to ask as well, just with, I know now that there's been like, and I don't know exactly when this started, but in terms of, you know, with the city, you know, trying to, you know, leaders trying to attract more creative, you know, workers that are working in tech, you know, in the tech industry and in creative endeavors. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering in terms of, do you see that there's any shift with, you know, the role of bringing this, you know, new and cutting edge art to a city that is trying to a certain degree to try to attract more, you know, more creatives to, you know, to the city? I don't know if that makes sense. That's just kind of.
No, I know what you mean. well, Richard Florida had an amazing book called The Creative Class. And his idea was different than our idea as the artists down in the Arts District initially. You know, our idea was to find a place that we could afford, that was cheap, that wasn't fixed up, so it wasn't precious, that we could do what we wanted and afford it. And his idea, Richard Florida's idea, was to try to bring in the creative people and to change the fabric of the society. And, you know, the first time I heard, I was at a political gathering for a mayor that didn't make it. you know, they were asking the artists, it was a group of artists, and they were asking us all, well, what do you think we should do in Tulsa? And I said, well, I think we should have affordable housing. I think we should have affordable studio space and affordable galleries, et cetera, and a place for performance art to happen. And Craig Kallenberger was at that meeting. I'll never forget this. And they asked him, and he said, well, I think we should bring artists in from the outside and give them money to live here and to try to make it happen for Tulsa through the osmosis of them being here. And I thought, well, that's not right. I just don't agree with him at all. And went away from that meeting thinking about that. And eventually I saw it as a parallel line, you know, two parallel lines that were, we need to support the local artists and we need to support other stimulating ideas from the outside. And I think the Kaiser Foundation has done a fabulous job of that. And I know there's some grumbling in Tulsa right now about the work that they've done. But I tell you, it takes a visionary and it takes money to make something like this happen. And it really, really is. And vision, I mean, how do you change the creative class in Tulsa to start thinking in new ways and use our intellects as well as our intuitive side to blend together into stimulating artworks and performances? And I can't really say anything bad about my experience with Kaiser Foundation, really. You know, they came to us over on Kenosha and said, you know, hey, we'd like for you to come and be a part of this. And I said, oh, no, not me. I am going to completely resist this. And
That's great.
You know, and one of my board members came to me and said, you know, imagine it's 10 years from now, Steve, and you're over here on Kenosha and everything is happening over on Brady.
Wow.
How will you feel? You know, and you're not getting anybody to come here. And I thought, wow, you know, if we could keep our mission and not be censored by this collaboration with Kaiser, then maybe it would work. And so I told Ken Levitt, he came over and I said, okay, one condition, that we are never censored. And, wow, you know, we never had been. We never have been, to my knowledge. We've never, until the time I retired anyway, been censored by the Kaiser Foundation. And, boy, I tell you, we've done some great shit, you know?
I love that.
I mean, how many totally nude performances have been done in Tulsa, in the Tulsa Performing Arts Center?
Wow.
That's the credit to Shirley Elliott, as well as their ability to trust that we would handle it with respect. How many pieces have happened where, you know, it was a video of men fucking the earth?
Wow.
How many of the pieces that we have done, not many were like that because it wasn't necessary, but if it was important to the meaning of the artwork, where can you do that other than Living Arts? Why do you go to New York or San Francisco and see those kind of works and you don't see them here in Tulsa? Why are we constantly looking at, you know, the Patsy Cline story or The Lion King over and over and over every year? It's like, oh, please just give me some stimulating contemporary art and I'll be happy. So there has to be a Living Arts doing that in order for that to actually be out there, you know? Otherwise, it'll just be, you know, another community arts center.
One, and it just the same thing, the same way. And my goodness. I got to tell you, Steve, this has been an absolute pleasure. I cannot tell you how much reverence I have for what you're, is it okay to call this a legacy? I don't know if that's, I've never asked anybody if I could say that. I've never said that before. So
I mean, I've had several retrospectives, which were kind of legacy exhibits, already. And, until I croak, then, you know, it's all legacy all the time.
I totally love that. Absolutely. Thank you so much. This has been just an incredible, incredible pleasure to hear about this and in your own words from you. And it just means the world to me that you've taken the time and shared this today. I know I've enjoyed this incredibly, and I really feel like other people will as well. Yeah.
Good.
It means the world.
Good.
Thank you so much. I appreciate
it. You're welcome.